Norman Stories, written by Norman and read by Norman. We had been living in wartime England now for almost 4 years. It was the only life that children knew or remembered. Strangely, we'd been evacuated to Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire, which was used as an army firing range. So we regularly witnessed German and English fighters trying to kill each other in the skies above us. The village itself had been bombed and machine-gunned twice, but fortunately no one was killed or hurt. It has always struck me as a strange place to evacuate children for their safety. I think, for us, the war was an exciting place to be. Our games were war games, and we accepted that there was nothing available, and it soon became a normal way of life. When the Americans came into the war, it became their playground, and we were thrown gum and sweets from the convoys of tanks and personnel carriers that always seemed to be rattling their way through the village. They were very generous, the Americans, but what I didn't understand until later was why black Americans and white American soldiers had to be kept apart. I mean, weren't they on the same side? Until, that is, a racist southerner screamed at me one day when I waved back at a black soldier. I saw such hatred in his face. My first experience of racism. The children always got on very well with the soldiers as they desperately missed their families. Very few families are not affected by the war, whether it's fathers and mothers, cousins and nephews, or brothers and sisters. So my next story is called My Brother Reg. He was 9 years older than me, my big brother that I adored. Full of life and fun, we would wrestle each other and laugh. We were real mates. He could do no wrong in my eyes. And when he became Air Cadets boxing champion, I thought I would die with pride. Quiet and always smiling, he had a way with the girls that made their hearts melt. But it was always in fun. He would take me out with them and was always generous and thoughtful and loving. So when at the age of 7 they evacuated all children from London and I was one of the first to go, it was very hard parting from him. I had another brother 2 years older than me who would be coming too, but that was different. Nothing can take the place of a big brother's love. All the good times we had, all the races we had run and all the fun would be gone. I would miss him a lot. He wrote to me often in Chitton, the small Wiltshire village where I had been evacuated. Funny little letters that always cheered me up if I was down. And he promised to come and visit us. But it was over a year before he did. He had volunteered for the Air Force and been accepted for training in a few weeks, so he would come down and see us before he went. He was 17. We crammed everything into those few days that he was here. Walks on the downs, cycling, rabbiting. I made everyone meet him who would listen, and he even came to church with me. Still a keen boxer, he was up at 5 every morning, running over the downs in shorts and singlet, stopping off at the farms to drink fresh milk. The village took to him and liked him, and soon he knew everybody by first names. He loved the village life, and the girls would giggle as we passed, and when I was in bed, he courted them, and they were always willing. The day came when he had to leave. We all cried. It had been marvellous fun, and I wanted it to go on forever. and as he pressed his face against the window of the village bus that was taking him to Salisbury, he promised that he would come back soon. His letters came less frequently now that he was in the Air Force, and they weren't so funny. But he seemed happy and excited being a rear gunner in a Lancaster bomber flying raids over France and Germany. Because of his cadet training, he was quickly made a sergeant and sent us photographs of himself with his stripes grouped around the bombers with his mates, himself always smiling boyishly in the middle. The letters suddenly stopped. We weren't told at first. No one was sure. He was just missing, as the telegram said. Mention of his name brought an embarrassed silence to the house. But we never guessed anything was wrong until one day it was casually dropped that Reggie was missing. As casually as you could drop to a child that half of him was lost. They told us that maybe he was all right and had been taken prisoner, though they already knew that he was dead. The second telegram had arrived, and it was confirmed. He was 19 years old. We were allowed to stay off school that day and wandered off in no particular direction, walking and sometimes running as fast as I could, as if to run away from what I'd been told. I ran over the downs to familiar places and hoped and prayed that he would be all right. But I knew he was dead. I could just tell. Alone, I lay on my belly and started to cry until it hurt, until there was no more tears in me or the world. I kicked at the ground with my toes and vowed I would never go to church again as long as I lived, and I stayed in that spot until it got dark. The villagers had heard and were gentle, but their kindness swelled up my loss, and I could speak to no one. Village girls wept openly when they said his name. My foster parents told me quickly that he was dead. They both knew that I knew, and I hated them for the sake of hating something real rather than something as abstract as the Germans. The war ended soon after, and we were brought back to London after 5 years. I remembered nothing of the place where I was born. Prisoners were released on both sides as quickly as possible to get us all back to normal. 4 of my brother's crew members had bailed out after they were hit and had been taken prisoner. They came to see my mother when they returned to England, and she insisted on hearing every detail, as she wanted to know, as if she could not really believe, until someone told her who was there. That day, we children were barred from the front room with all its comings and goings and talking, and we had to find our own way to grieve, as if being protected from the truth would make it easier for us. But of course, it didn't. The plane was shot down by a German fighter over France, and my brother was the first to go, as rear gunners usually were. He was dead before they came down. They couldn't get the boy of 19 out, jammed as he was in his flying suit, they said. When I was 15, I wanted to see his grave. Flight Sergeant R. Bowler, buried just outside Amiens in northern France, the War Commission had said. Arriving in Amiens was easy, though I spoke no French and had very little money in my pocket, but finding the cemetery that was out in the country seemed impossible. No one understood the address or the drawings of crosses and graves that I made on bits of paper. I slept that night in the station, and began my search in the morning as soon as I awoke with whoever was about. Small crowds would gather and shout, and I would shout back as if that's what they understood. But no one did, until a French soldier, who knew a few words of English, translated word by word to the crowd. Amiens was scarred, with bombed-out buildings, and the people still suffered from years of occupation. My search seemed to have come to an end, and I felt confused and in despair, until a schoolteacher, who spoke English, showed me the way on his map. Soon I was on my way across that flat French countryside, so different from the Wiltshire Downs that I knew. I walked the last 3 miles to the cemetery, feeling excited, as if I was really going to meet Reggie. But that feeling soon left me when I saw with horror the field of graves where hundreds of Englishmen were lined up for the last time. I wandered up and down the endless rows and read their names on the white crosses until I found Reggie's. The old feeling of loss swelled up inside me, and I cried for him again.